From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the fourth day of November 2016. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. A bit later in the program, we'll check in on the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass of Agrible from right here in Champaign County, Illinois. Along the way, we'll check in on the news. And a bit later in the program, if you can stay with us for the whole hour, we'll bring you Commodity Week with our guests this week, Dan Zwicker, Amy Sage, and Jason Clapp. And it all happens right here on Agricultural Programming from Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Let's turn our attention to the futures markets. Mike Zuzulo is here. He's from Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Atchison, Kansas. Always joins us on Fridays. Hey, Mike, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you again, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with something that's not in the agricultural world exactly this morning. The jobs report was pretty good. What'd you think of it?
Yeah, non-farm payrolls increased 161,000 for the month, and this would be October, and we did see unemployment rate drop down to about 4.9%. I felt like the dollar especially handled this report very well. It did not go up sharply on what you would think would be a strong dollar policy. With the idea that this was a jobs report that the Federal Reserve would look at as a green light to go ahead and raise interest rates in December, especially given their meeting this past week. And the indications or the inferences were still there that they were on track for getting us one more interest rate hike before the end of the calendar year. And obviously they left open the election. And I think that in and of itself, along with a couple other things, made the election on Tuesday a lot more important to the markets, maybe more than they should be or more than they would have been if a light had not been shown on it by some people like the Federal Reserve.
Do producers ask you about this very often?
That's been a big conversation this week as far as a topic, Todd, and I think it was especially pertinent when we saw the polls with Hillary Clinton leading, where that was taking the dollar higher, the stock market higher, and the gold lower and the crude oil higher. And so the market was in favor, I think, generally speaking, of Clinton leading in the polls. When Trump started to win in this week's polls and come around in some of these key states and actually go ahead, we saw about a 1.3% drop in the dollar and the DEIS dollar index. And we've also seen the crude oil this week now, as of today, drop back to its lowest level since August 11th. It's essentially wiped out $10 of rally that it put in place since the later part of September. It's a conversation topic because I think that it really kept out demand bulls out of the grain market this week. Between the report on Wednesday and all the estimates coming out, and then this elevated concern about the election Tuesday, I think the trade just sat there and said to themselves, why would we want to step in front of the U.S. elections on Tuesday and then the grain report on Wednesday? Let's just wait till Wednesday before we really take a buy-side position.
What do you think about that Wednesday report, speaking of it?
I'll put it to you this way. I'm writing the weekly weekend newsletter right now for the week, and I'm going to make a bullish contrarian case for this grain market if the technicals hold after Tuesday's and Wednesday's fundamental firestorms hit the grain markets, because some of the most reliable longer-term indicators that I use are bottoming out and have not been doing poorly in the last couple weeks. And it's been several weeks that they've been trying to build a base in these indicators. And even with the corn down and the beans down this past week, I think that there are some really good areas of daylight in the longer term charts and longer term indicators that I use. And so if I can get through Tuesday and Wednesday unscathed in these indicators, I think to myself, with harvest wrapping up, with these indicators out of these fundamentals out of the way, why wouldn't you maybe make the case for a bullish run to the upside? So that's kind of how I'm looking at Wednesday's report. Another one of those reports where the market's scared about bigger supplies. They've ignored the demand side, both the export demand in corn and beans and the crush and ethanol demand in corn and beans, and really focused on bigger yield potential.
Now, are you thinking something like 6 months worth of more strength. And I'm looking at South American crop coming in sometime in April or thereabouts.
Exactly right. You know, the biggest flag to me this week was when we did see the shift in the polls and the dollar went down, even with the crude oil losing what it did, the ag sector, both cattle, hogs, grains, all held up very, very well against that. And I think the other thing that I saw was bonds going down, interest rates going up, the gold going up, and the dollar going down with equities going down. How long it's been since we've seen that kind of a pattern. Todd, that's just simply put, that's got a big eye right in front of all those inflationary bias. And you can't make this week and last week a trend, but if you pull out next week as well, now that we've skipped over into November after this Tuesday election and Wednesday fundamental data, I think it really promotes the idea that the investment side of the equation may come in and want to buy this market indeed for the next 6 months.
And supported by the idea that the Federal Reserve will continue to raise their interest rates.
Not only supported by that, but the Federal Reserve actually in some of their actual conversations and presentations and speeches actually encouraging inflation expectations, trying to bring about a shift in investor philosophy. And that's where the bond market really plays and the VIX really plays a big role. Those two markets are the bond yields are going up and the VIX are going up at the same time in a rational, not too scary fashion. That's very inflationary, something we've been waiting on literally for 7 years to happen.
Are farmers then, in your opinion, already set for this potential, meaning they probably own more of both the corn and the soybeans than they have in the past at this point in the harvest season?
I would say maybe as much as we've owned in the last 3 to 5 years in the corn, excluding 2012. But I actually think the farmers are pretty lean and don't have a lot of beans on hand right now. I think colleagues in Chicago have been talking to me about their clients looking for a place to buy back beans. I certainly have more clients this year than last talking about a place that they want to buy back beans. And I would say that would be subscribers and cash only clients are even looking and wanting to get some information from me on that as well. So I think the farmers did a really good job given the yield, given the price, looking at the revenue, saying, why wouldn't I take this in case South America does have a good crop?
Hey, two things. One, I'm looking forward to having you on Commodity Week next week and doing it live, to tape that is, or in this case, to digital SD card, at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, and then having you here for the Farm Assets Conference on the 22nd day of November.
I am super excited, and the biggest question that the producers have to ask themselves ahead of that conference is, will we raffle off another Christmas Story leg lamp?
I forgot about that.
Looking forward to it, Todd.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. That, of course, is Mike Zuzulo. He's at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. You can buy your tickets to the Farm Assets Conference right now today. They're just $30, farmassetsconference.com, to find all the details. It's the 22nd day of November, the Tuesday prior to Thanksgiving in Normal, Illinois. In today's agricultural news, farmers have been weighing in on the proposed estate tax changes. Of the nearly 9,500 comments on the Treasury Department's proposed rule to crack down on a maneuver wealthy business owners use to avoid paying estate taxes when transferring assets to family members, about 16% cited the potential negative impact on farmers as reasons for the opposition. The Indiana Farm Bureau, in particular, launched an organized campaign calling on Treasury to withdraw the proposal, with 400 members filing comments saying that it would make it more difficult for families to offer ownership to those well-positioned to continue to operate the business when there's a death in the family. Estates valued in excess of $5.45 million are subject to the levy. About 10,000 of the largest estates have to file estate tax returns in any given year, according to the IRS. USDA estimates that less than 1% of farming operations owe the estate tax last year. The National Farmers Union says it's not opposed to the tax in general, but is concerned with Treasury's proposal in particular because it doesn't account for the unique challenges that occur in agriculture. Well, from the estate tax, let's move to what some are calling a McDonald's moment for the broiler chicken industry. In August, the Humane Society of the United States, or HSUS, put the poultry industry on notice. With the cage-free egg war all but won, the group would train, it says, its fire on broiler chicken producers. It went on to write a letter to the CEOs of major poultry companies saying, as we look to the future, our focus is likely to shift toward broiler welfare issues. It also extended an offer to talk privately. If anyone doubted the Humane Society's resolve, they got their answer yesterday when two of the biggest food vendors in the country, Compass Group USA and Aramark, announced they would source only humanely raised chickens by 2024. We'll stay with the HSUS because it looks like it may have some budget problems, so it's been brushing off a report that says it's having financial difficulties. The talk of challenges within the organization started Tuesday of this week when the Center for Consumer Freedom put out a press release saying that HSUS laid off 10% of its staff amid a budget shortfall, which the release said was at least $20 million. The center is run by lobbyist Richard Berman, a longtime opponent of HSUS and other groups that believe in greater government regulation. The Humane Society says it eliminated several dozen positions as part of a restructuring effort. HSUS CEO Wayne Pacell said the numbers put out by the Center for Consumer Freedom are just wrong. Pacell added that the group's assets were down a few million in the first 9 months of the year, but they do expect those numbers to rise, as many Americans typically wait until the end of the year for their charitable giving. And finally today, we'll look overseas, but stay with animal agriculture. With the prospect of low cattle prices and increasing beef supplies in the immediate future, the Federation of State Beef Councils announced that it's investing almost $1 million to stimulate more overseas demand for American beef. With strong encouragement from State Beef Council partners, the Federation will invest $940,000 from its reserves to promote beef in several overseas markets. For example, the group will spend $260,000 for promotions in Japan, with the goal of moving an additional 6.9 million pounds of U.S. beef. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We spend some of our time, at least some of us do, thinking about the future and our finances and how we might be able to protect ourselves. One of the ways that might possibly be a good option and that we may not consider very often is health insurance. And we're joined now by Kathy Swedler. She's a consumer economics educator with University of Illinois Extension to discuss this a little bit. So Kathy, I don't think about health insurance all that often as part of my financial plan. Why should I?
Well, I think most of us just don't want to think of health insurance, period, whether it's part of our financial plan or another thing. We don't like to think about getting sick. And we certainly don't like to think of something catastrophic happening, whether it was a major illness or an accident. But as we know, life does happen, and sometimes it doesn't go along the way we want. And if we have one of those large medical costs, that's where health insurance makes a big difference in terms of our financial security.
Give me examples.
Well, so if you don't have health insurance, and or then when you have to be hospitalized and then you may not be getting paid because you're not working, then you're going to see a real hit to your family income between not only not working, but also the fact that you're going to have these large medical bills. And what we know is that that what happens is that medical debts end up contributing to over half of debt collection actions in the U.S., and almost half of all the bankruptcies in the United States. So it's clear that medical costs really do impact people's financial security.
Can you put this in context in terms of how much money I actually make and how much protection I need?
While it's always wonderful when our insurance covers those small costs, you know, whether it's, a doctor visit or, antibiotics for a sinus infection or whatever. And I know those don't necessarily seem small, but compared to something catastrophic, they are. So that's great. But what it can also do for you is really protect you from these catastrophic events, because then the plans will really jump in and really pay for almost all those costs. And that's what we're thinking about for health insurance. You know, it's the same thing if you think about it when you buy auto insurance. You know, if somebody opens their door and dents your car and puts a little ding in the paint, most of us don't run to our insurance companies because we figure that's going to be either not going to reach our deductible, or it's going to put us in a, you know, perhaps a higher insurance level. So we're not really picking up that health insurance for those dings, right? We're getting that health insurance for that major accident where our car is totaled and we need a new car. So sometimes I think we need to step back and think about, what is this health insurance do for us? Is it, yes, it's helping us with our daily small medical things, but it's really protecting us from something where we won't be able to recover otherwise financially.
Are there things that I should look for? For instance, when I'm doing auto policies, if I have an old pickup truck, I may only protect myself and not the truck, right?
Right. So I think exactly along those same lines, if you're a younger person that is, healthy, not inclined to be having a lot of different medicines and things like that, and what you're really trying to do is protect yourself from that catastrophic event, then look for an insurance policy that gives you a higher deductible. The deductible is the part you have to pay before the insurance kicks in. And that way, it'll get your monthly premium down, the monthly amount that you have to pay, and you're really just insuring yourself for that catastrophic. Maybe in the old days, we would have called that like a major medical plan, that was a term that was used more that I know, for example, that I had when I was a young adult. And so, yes, I had to make those choices about whether I was going to go to the doctor for a sinus infection or just, you know, struggle through it because I didn't want to pay that visit. But I did know I had that protection if something really huge happened to me.
Any other items we should discuss on this issue of financial planning and your health?
I think it's one of those things, too, that, right now, a lot of young adults can stay on their parents' plan until they reach 26, which is the result of the Affordable Care Act that was extended from 18. You know, if you are a parent or a grandparent and you have one of those young adults that's aging off that plan, you might need to do a little nudging about, you know, what's your next step? What are you going to do to cover yourself for that catastrophic event, if it should happen, which we don't want to happen, but it's going to happen to somebody.
That's Kathy Sweetler of University of Illinois Extension. You're listening to Agricultural Programming from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, joined now by Eric Snodgrass. He's at Agrible. Hey, Eric, thanks for being with us. Can you check up on the weather forecast for me, please?
Well, Todd, let's start with the severe storms that we had on Wednesday night. We had this really classic setup for a mesoscale convective system, which we call squall lines. And that squall line pushed across the western half of the state and moved right across Peoria, Bloomington, Springfield, Decatur, and eventually to Champaign. And I'll tell you, it produced some pretty strong winds. I saw some reports of wind speeds over 60 miles an hour. And then if you were up near Peoria or Bloomington, boy, they had some pretty sizable hail. In fact, some of the hailstones were getting up to be 1 3/4 inches in diameter. And hail that big falls fast, faster than about 90 miles an hour, which means if it hits you, you're going to get hurt. But basically, after that front passed and that severe weather moved out with it, we had a cold front that came through yesterday, and that cold front really helped to clear things out, lighten up our winds, and give us the beautiful day that we have today on Friday. In fact, I'm expecting high pressure to take over and stick around here for several more days. You got a beautiful weekend on tap. You got very light winds for the football game on Saturday. And we're expecting highs in the 60s all the way through next week. And right now, there are no strong signals for precipitation much next week either. So where should we be for this time of year? Let's kind of compare what we're getting to what we should be, what we should be getting for this time of year. Well, here we are at the beginning of November. Our average high temperatures for this time of year are in the middle to upper 50s, but by the time mid-November gets here, we should be in the low 50s or approaching 50 degrees. Now, that's climatological averages. Here we are, almost a full month past our average frost date, and we're still seeing temperatures that are getting up into the upper 60s, maybe even into the 70s. Now, why is all this happening? Well, basically, we have had the flow pattern in the atmosphere dominated by a huge ridge in the jet stream, and that ridge just doesn't want to move. And that's one of the reasons why NOAA has been forecasting, as we have, for quite some time for a very, very warm start to November. But I'll tell you this, in the long-range outlook, we are starting to see that system retrograde, which means it's going to move to the west with time. And that only moves to the west with time because the Aleutian Low, which sits south of Alaska, also moves west. That's going to give us our first real chance at a pattern change across the central and eastern United States. And what that's going to allow to have happen is that some cooler air is finally going to sag into our region from Canada. But it's not going to be bitterly cold. And the reasons for this are kind of fourfold here, so check this out. One of the problems we're going to have with getting really cold air into the Midwest for the start of winter is going to be the fact that it's not cold in Canada right now. Canada has also been dealing with this ridge, and it's been warmer than average there too. Secondly, the sea ice in the Arctic is at an all-time minimum for October. We've been keeping records of sea ice in the Arctic since about 1979. So that just means we have a smaller area over which we are having a strong reflection of solar radiation, and therefore it gets warmer than it would be normally. The other thing is we got all the cold air piled way up in Siberia rather than over Canada or northern Canada. And as a result, the warmth in Canada means we don't have much cool air there to push into the Midwest. That's why when I say the pattern's going to change, we're not expecting it to change to where it's going to get really, really cold, but it'll certainly feel cold compared to what we've had so far. And finally, you know, one of the big controlling factors we like to look for in winter is either a strong El Nino or La Nina, because they can really dominate the flow and make weather more predictable. We have neither. In fact, right now we have just a very weak La Nina, which isn't doing much to impact the flow pattern of the jet stream at this point. And as I finish up here, let me turn my attention quickly to South America. We've been talking about how the rains have returned to the northern growing regions, and that's really been great for them recovering the water that they need in the soil as they head into planting. But there have been some reports that southern Brazil, as we actually had forecast a couple weeks ago, of being way wetter than normal, and I'll tell you, so has northern Argentina. Now, the fact that they're so wet has actually led to some flooding problems. And I read a report this morning that even though about 30% of the entire corn crop has been planted in Argentina, something like 500,000 or more hectares of land have experienced flooding recently. And that's leading some folks to do some replanting. Now, just to make a case in point here, if this were a year with a very strong La Nina, we would expect the southern growing regions to be going into drought as the growing season evolves in South America. So it's a lot to digest, but some really interesting stuff going on in the weather that affects agriculture right now.
Hey, thanks, Eric. Eric Snodgrass, of course, is with Agrible. Find them online at agrible.com, or you can listen to him again on our website at willag.org. While you're there, make sure you buy your tickets for the Farm Assets Conference, just a few weeks away now. Find all the details at farmassetsconference.com.